This is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 114th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have with me today Peter Clay. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Gary. Thanks so much for having me.
Peter Clay, who we all call Pete, is the CISO of Qlik. Pete has more than 20 years of experience in technology change and its relationship to security from a risk management perspective. He's been directly involved in delivery of managed security services to global public and private sector organizations. Prior to serving as CISO of Qlik, Pete was CISO of Invitas. Full disclosure, I serve on the Invitas Advisory Board. Previous roles included work as federal CISO at Deloitte. Pete's clients have included the DoD, the U.S. Navy, DHS, TSA, NOAA, and other agencies. Pete attended Oxford and graduated from Hendricks College. He lives in Virginia, and he's currently in Charlottesville. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
So you've been a security executive or worked closely with security executives at the highest levels for multiple decades. What kind of evolution have you seen in the CISO role?
It has moved so notably even within the last 5 years that it's almost unrecognizable from what it was. I think the CISO kind of started off as almost a hybrid role of being a little bit focused on technology, a little bit focused on legal, and a little bit focused on simply being an executive and a member of the business team. It's moved much more now in public companies to being truly more in the risk management focused area. So they're looking more at policy and procedures and how do we manage SOCs and how do we manage these things and advising the technology teams on how to adequately secure the environment. The CISO has also become much more of a team leader than a solo practitioner. The focus has moved not just from IT, but understanding that information security requires everybody from legal through talent and culture, certainly the business and finance folks, as well as simply business operations. And because they have such a broad impact across the business, the traditional role just didn't seem to fit. So it's become a much broader, more business executive facing role.
Was the traditional role just geekier in general, or was the role the same, but it turned out that the first generation of CISOs were geeks, and so they overemphasized the geeky aspect?
I don't think it was so much that they overemphasized the geeky aspect. In fact, in a lot of conversations that I'm having now, one of the enormous challenges facing the CISO ranks is maybe they don't have enough technology experience.
Ah.
In changing the focus, it really has become almost that there weren't enough of the original group of CISOs to fill the expanding need. You know, 5 years ago, it took a fairly large company or a fairly complex organization to have somebody called a chief information security officer. Now that role has really moved down, you know, probably out of the global 500 and into probably the global 25,000, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more need for people and not enough people.
Right. And so you're also seeing people from non-traditional backgrounds coming into it. There are a lot more attorneys, a lot more accountants, a lot more even scary people like history majors that come into the field.
And, hey, you know, wait a minute, successful. I'm a philosophy major here. What are you saying?
And I was a history major, so I can make fun of myself. The challenge there, though, is without enough, you know, the question is the quality still there? And are the right steps being taken, you know, across the board when you look at information security as you know, not just a market, but as a group of professionals serving a greater need?
So you mentioned a number of the major constituency that a CISO has to interact with, like, you know, the IT guys and network security people, legal, the compliance people, audit and risk management and executives. If you had to sort of divide that up in terms of percentages among those four major constituencies, how would it come out?
I tend to spend 50 to 60% of my days, weeks, and months with the technology people, because I come from the school of, you know, chief information security officers that believe that technology can provide a great many of the solutions that we're looking for and provide them in a programmatic and systemic way that can impact the organization fast enough and in significant enough quantity to actually make a difference. I also happen to believe that since in many, many cases, not all, but many cases, the threat that we're facing is technology-based, we have to be as fast as the attackers coming in.
Mm-hmm.
The next group that I spend time with on a continuous basis are the is the Office of General Counsel. I probably have almost an equal number of relationships and contacts within various OGC and attorney ranks as I do within the IT community. After that certainly comes talent, because one of the great issues and the hot button issues today is insider threat. But the question that companies are really starting to manage and trying to manage is, you know, how do you manage your insider threat effectively without turning it into, you know, roughly a police state where everybody feels that they're under the microcosm?
Right.
And that's really the talent question. And then finally would be the executive team, because they want to know what's going on, and they read something in the paper and they want that answer.
Mm-hmm. And do you have to do something to change, you know, the discussion that happens in the press and that happens in public, to turn it into much more of a business focus for the executives?
I think I actually have to interpret what happened, because the press is always interested on almost the salacious piece of it.
Right.
What happened and how it happened oftentimes gets lost. It's also been really interesting to watch the growth of crisis management.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when one large retailer was broken into, that got all the news. The fact that a second large retailer was, you know, also similarly penetrated, but whose, you know, lead security architect was actually under indictment by the federal government for hacking into a previous company, that didn't get nearly the play in the press, even though the impact of the attack was actually larger.
Uh-huh.
And so crisis management and understanding how to position what happens when something goes bad is a very effective way of managing the press. Unfortunately, it doesn't get us to an understanding of what actually happened. And so scaring people and using that old, you know, bromide of fear, uncertainty, and doubt is only useful for a short period of time, because the way to be successful in information security, as you well know, is to build it in as a programmatic function that is continuously seeking to improve and evolve as the threats change and as the needs change.
So let's compare and contrast your most recent work for startups versus your previous career as a consultant for the government. Go.
First of all, I have to admit, and this is something I say publicly from every stage that I've ever taken in every public forum that I speak in, I spent almost 18 years as an IT consultant, 15 of those and as an information security consultant. And the first year that I started leading an information security group in practice, I really had cause to sit down and think about some of the things that I had said as a consultant. And I almost wanted to call those people up and just apologize.
Oh, that's hilarious. Give me some examples.
You know, your identity management solution should look like this. Well, I didn't take into account all the different stakeholders and all the different processes. I just gave a book solution. Well, you can use, you know, this vulnerability scanning tool because it's always right. Just silly things like that that really, you know, they make sense as the consultant, because your job is to move through, you know, a basic statement of work. But from operating an environment over time, it doesn't necessarily work out so well. And again, going back and talking about the harder and heavier lifting around maturity models and things that aren't as sexy as vulnerability scanners and pen testing and those sorts of things are the way to actually help an information security program get to where it needs to effectively be to manage the risk.
Yeah, and that involves measurement, which is lacking in security in general, so that you kind of know where you sit, where you stand, and then you can build a longer-term strategy instead of a quick strategy.
Absolutely. We have to take, and I've never, even though I've got a little bit of a military background, I'm never a big fan of comparing information security, you know, to military tactics and military things, because it really doesn't fit. You know, probably the stupidest thing that we can really ever talk about is cyber war. Mm. There's a conflict of competing interests, but that in no way approaches a warfare scenario.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, understanding that when you have a series of small actors that can penetrate a network using pretty commonly available issues and vulnerabilities that are commonly left open, they're not all zero-day exploits. The only way to actively combat that is to not be hypnotized by, well, so-and-so was able to break in at this point. Yes, we have to mitigate the impact, but you have to implement that programmatic standard that goes out over time, not just within your organization, but within the broader community. Because it's not just the more you tighten up, it's the more you can effectively share information without legal ramifications. That's how information security gets better.
So I think you did a good job characterizing the difference between acting as a consultant, especially in the government, and acting as a private sector person and an executive at one place. But let's talk about startups and pace. How does the role of a CISO reconcile with, you know, being an executive in a startup?
It reconciles pretty well, actually, because one of the things that's really easy to get hypnotized by when you're at a large corporation is the fact that it takes 3, 6, 9 months, a year to make a change. Information security as just the pace of the profession is incredibly fast-paced. I've seen some studies that show that the information turnover for security professionals just to stay on top of where they are is probably 25 to 30% per year. So that goes far beyond just that, 40 hours of CPE that we all try to hit. You have to be actively engaged in it. Within a startup, you have to be similarly engaged in all of the details that are going on in the business, and really be focused on what is the end goal that we're trying to reach as an organization, and understand that line will be anything in the world, any direction you want, but straight. It's going to be messy, it's going to be confusing, and it's going to be challenging. So I think the two disciplines fit together very, very well. How you implement information security at a startup is becoming increasingly important, because companies are now starting to look to secure their data supply chain. So if data is the new gold, and Google started the gold rush of 1849 by teaching us about how valuable data is, if data is the new gold, and we are now responsible to each other, both contractually and ethically, to protect each other's data, and we have to do that very quickly, and with less resources, typically, than you're going to find a large company, then you still have to be not just compliant is such a bad loaded word anymore. You still have to effectively manage the risk to your own and other people's information security or data without compromising or making too many compromises that can let the bad guys both internally and externally in. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I want to go back and think about the government approach then a little bit and how it evolved over the last, say, 15 years and where it is now relative to the private sector.
I think that there's really three different answers when you talk about the government approach. I think that you have a tier of entities which have long recognized, because they've dealt in the use and exploitation of information for multiple decades, 60, 70, 80 years. I think in those areas, you have very different information security cultures, and there's almost no reflection anywhere else. In some cases, they're incredibly overboard and they're so unwieldy at this point that they actually lose the flexibility to secure the data. And in other cases, you know, they've done a pretty fantastic job of getting it done. You've got a middle tier set of agencies, to include some of the state agencies now, that have definitely taken the time and put the frameworks in place. But the challenge that they face is the federal information security standards that are published are an auditor's dream, but I'm not sure that they're particularly useful for an information security professional.
Hmm.
By the time you get done writing the 600 to 800 pages of documents that go into one of those into, quote, being compliant there, the bad guys are pretty much in your network and having a good time. And you've done nothing to effectively secure your environment, both internally and externally.
So too much bureaucracy and not enough real activity.
Absolutely. I mean, think about the effect of, do I spend 500 hours writing a security plan, in which that's going to be somewhat effective, at least in communicating what I'm supposed to be doing, or am I going to spend 500 hours spending time doing code reviews and vulnerability scans and, you know, code analysis for the major applications in my environment? Which one is going to be valuable today and tomorrow for keeping, you know, untoward events from happening? There's got to be a better balance there, is really what we're driving to.
Mm-hmm.
There's a third tier of the government that honestly just doesn't get it. They spend money on stuff. They're very focused on being compliant. Some of them get A's in various scorecards. And what happens is when you look at the numbers over time, they're broken into at an incredible rate and an incredible frequency. So almost hiding that third group of almost hiding behind the bureaucracy becomes, you know, almost the worst possible outcome.
Hmm.
Look, we did all the paperwork. Yeah, but you didn't secure your applications. You didn't secure your environments. And you tried to push some of that stuff off. So I think, you know, to kind of summarize it, the government approach, if you cut down the bureaucracy and the paperwork and focus on the action steps, you can get some incredibly good results. But if you focus only on paperwork or only trying to make somebody else happy with how you're running your information security program, I'm not sure that I know of a faster path to failure.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. Let's talk about reactive approaches to security, which have been evolving rapidly and really under the influence of the spooks, if you want to put it that way, the intelligence community, into this notion of orchestrated response, which involves detection of attack and detection of compromise, and then figuring out what to do once you've detected it. And speeding that cycle up is pretty important, I suppose. But it seems like if you focus on just reactive approaches like that, you miss out on the notion of preventing attacks by building security properly in the first place.
The challenge, and certainly where in my mind the profession has moved to today, is regardless of the size of organization, you have to take the programmatic approach to security. Taking a reactive approach of somebody is doing something to me at any given point, first of all, puts you behind the attacker by quite a bit, because by the time you normally detect it and understand it in the context of your network, you're already at a point of failure or well past the point of failure. Taking the programmatic approach and building security into the applications and the networks and your cloud environment and your supplier, your data supply chain, is the only way that we're ever going to get to the true preventive controls that we need to have. That's where the mix comes in of understanding, is there, you know, it's not just technology, it is truly, you know, people, process, and technology all together. But the process piece of that not ignores, you have to react to attacks, particularly attacks that get past a number of your defenses. Mm-hmm. But those aren't nearly the important benchmarks, except, you know, to say, look, we had this issue and now we need to take these actions. That doesn't get you as far down the road as saying, these are, you know, the classic example, these are the risks, these are the threats, this is how we're going to programmatically address this. And so the attacks then, when they come, even if they're partially successful, that shouldn't be the headline news. The fact that you were able to detect them is actually a good sign of a maturing environment. The fact that you were able to respond in time, good sign of a maturing environment. And then finally, the fact that you were able to remediate and get back online and you know, be resilient, again, those are all the hallmarks of a successful program. So mm-hmm. attacks in that space, while they may get headlines both inside or outside an organization, don't really drive your security program.
The idea of planning for an attack is always part of building security in as well.
Sure.
That's worth pointing out. Back in my machine learning days about 20 years ago, we built systems that would classify and categorize input and then respond in some way. Do you think that AI and machine learning are going to take over orchestration?
I don't know that they're going to take over orchestration, because the one thing that I'm pretty sure of right now, as we go through the big data era and even working for a business intelligence company today, I think that there's an incredible challenge around AI, and that is putting data in context and truly understanding, you know, what an attack is and what is, you know, a hiccup, and calibrating those responses. I still believe that, you know, for the near term future, we're going to see the human in the loop to make help. First of all, rationalize the thinking or what the tools are saying, and then to be able to begin to direct the attack. I think once we start to mature those processes, however, more and more of the machine speed will be brought to bear as we, you know, as we understand that better. But right now, I don't think that the thinking and the understanding of, even if, you know, if you, the example of this is, go ask 10 security professionals what an attack is.
Right.
I can pretty much guarantee you're going to get 10 different answers. So you almost have to start with the vocabulary,
yep,
and then begin to build on that before you can teach the machines to go that direction.
Yeah, that was just a flyer. Interesting. Have we made enough progress on security engineering?
Not even close. Not even close. And in fact, one of the biggest complaints I'm hearing from both my peers and friends throughout the industry is, we've completely lost focus on security engineering, both as a discipline, but also as a value-added service across organizations. When you begin to think about what a security engineer can do and should be able to do, not just in the confidentiality, but also driving into the integrity and availability of information, they become actually a very critical role, not just in a security program, but also in just regular IT operation focus. Because that security professional can not only prevent people from getting information, they can also ensure that it's available in the form that it's supposed to be at the right time and at the right place. And if there's one thing in information security we continuously miss the boat on, it's we don't talk about how we can actually help and enable the organization to meet their specific data needs, and the security engineer is you know, probably the point of the spear for that one.
Mm-hmm. Or certainly should be part of the architectural discussion and part of the product strategy, I suppose. Thinking about how to build the system, security needs to be involved there.
Yeah, I would completely agree, because again, when we start talking about technology, the way you win in an information security role and you're working with operations is when you can truly build security in, you know, not just as a bolt-on after the application is done and trying to meet some regulatory guidance. But when you, you know, where I ask to get the architects that I work with involved is, you know, when the business guy and the IT guy are sitting in a bar and they scribble something on a bar napkin, I really want the next conversation to be with one of the security architects. Because if they'll do that, we can get it in, it's much less painful, and we can actually improve the quality of both the initial iteration of the application and successive ones as well.
So last topic. Though it comes and goes, there always seems to be something about cyber war in the air. What are your views on the cyber war situation and the notion of thinking about war as a metaphor for information security and the stuff you're working on right now?
It is fundamentally nonsense. When you think about cyber war, what we have done is a number of organizations decided that this would be yet another dimension of warfare that we should truly consider. So they built a market by making it very, very profitable to go out and find vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't think anybody counted on there was the fact that, well, when you make warfare available simply by going out, by having a sum of money to go out and buy a vulnerability, you not only take it out of the hands of some sort of control in the relationship between the nation state, but you also put it in the hands of you know, people that certainly don't have the best of intentions and, you know, much more commonly classed as criminals. The concept that two competing interests have to be termed war is almost solely an American concept. You can have competition for resources, you can have competition for ideas, without turning it into a military conflict.
Right. I think that maybe what helped to push it towards that set of ideas on the American side is that, you know, the early people in computer security often came from a military background.
Even coming from a military background, the first stance and the first point is preventing your own defeat is always in your own hands. It's how you prepare, it's how you train, it's how you understand the world, it's how you gather information. Your enemy, if you will, their defeat is also in their own hands. And by turning it into an attacker and a defender, rather than a competition for resources and understanding the value of data, it probably much more appropriately belongs in almost, you know, a legal law enforcement stance than it does a military stance.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
But you're now at a point where, because we are so computing dependent across all of the critical infrastructures, you're reaching a point now where over 100 countries in the world have some form of offensive cyber capabilities, according to published reports. And the only thing that we've truly understood about all that stuff is we now are in, you know, the cyber era of mutually assured destruction. I'm just not sure from a policy perspective if we really want to be in a position of mutually assured destruction with, you know, somebody like Bermuda.
Right. We can always bring our kinetic stuff to bear, I suppose, although it'd be wasted on Bermuda.
I think definitely it would be wasted on Bermuda. To quote Sun Tzu, you know, it's much better to capture something like that intact than to shatter it.
All right, last question. What's your favorite nonfiction book of all time?
William Manchester's The Last Lion, parts 1 and 2. The third volume was terrible.
And what's that about? I don't even know that book.
It's about the early life of Winston Churchill, and it does what great biographies should do, and that is it puts people in the context of their time. So, in, you know, there's all sorts of criticisms today of Churchill, and he was a racist, he was this, he was that. He was actually very much forward-thinking, and he was part of the story of how we got to where we are today, both in the UK and the US. Another book that's absolutely brilliant by the same author is called A World Lit Only by Fire. and it functionally, or not functionally, it actually tells the story of how we went from the Dark Ages, where life in Hobbes' version of the world, life was nasty, shortish, brutish, and short,
yep,
to reach the Middle Ages and then the Enlightenment. It tells that story in a way that I've never seen or heard it spoken of before. Then makes complete sense.
Cool. I'll have to put away my, you know, fiction only thing for a while and maybe check those books out. Thanks, Pete. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much, Gary. I appreciate you having me on, and I appreciate you taking the time this morning.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The July-August 2015 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine focuses on multidisciplinary security. The issue also features our interview with Katie Masuris. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.